Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden, and I'm working
at... An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Okay, good afternoon. My name's Brian Jundeff. I'm honored to be guest hosting once again for Chuck and Julie for the next hour or so. And I'm broadcasting from Boise, Idaho, where I am with my family for Thanksgiving. Sunny day up here. Very nice to be up here. Weather's probably similar to Denver. Boise is quite similar to Denver. You look outside, you see snow-capped mountains in the distance. It's really quite pretty. It seems to be what Denver was 20, 30 years ago. Smaller city, less congestion, less of the urban problems that Denver now faces that didn't face a couple of decades ago. But so be it. So what do we want to talk about today? If you have questions, please put them in the chat. This is should be interactive, sort of like talk radio. So it doesn't have to be me talking the entire time. You get bored listening to me, so I'm happy to answer some questions. But I want to talk a little bit about what I write about. As you may or may not know, I'm a writer for American Thinker, Rasmussen Reports, The Villager, which is the Arapahoe County newspaper. So those are my three main forums that I write for. And I like to write a lot about COVID. COVID's a popular subject these days, as no one can deny. So I want to talk about a few things, a couple of my recent articles. Call-in number? Sure, that works fine. So I want to talk about the rising COVID numbers. If you've watched the news lately, all you hear about is COVID, COVID, COVID. Hospitalizations are up, and in some states, they're higher. The numbers of hospitalizations are higher than they've been at any time during the pandemic, except for maybe last December. The positivity rate in Colorado is about 10% positive tests of those that get tested. And the Denver Post suggested 1 in 48 Coloradans are infected with COVID. And if so, this may be the worst spike that we've seen since the beginning of the pandemic. It really doesn't make sense, certainly on the surface, since about 80% of eligible Coloradans have received at least one vaccine dose thus far. So this suggests that the vaccines may not be working as well as advertised, or they should, or that vaccine immunity is waning a lot faster, hence the need for booster injections. Scarier still is that Colorado has instituted what they call crisis standards of care for hospital staffing. What does that mean? This allows hospitals and other facilities that are really stretched with personnel to use volunteers, including National Guard or family members, to help care for hospitalized patients. Colorado hospitals are already turning away patients based on an executive order by Governor Polis, redirecting them to other hospitals that may have more room. So if you're sick and show up at an emergency room, and you need to be hospitalized, you may be sent to a different hospital. That's not good. It's not only Colorado, but New Mexico is doing much the same with their crisis standards of care. Their case counts have climbed about 19% over the past couple of weeks. ICU beds are in short supply. Last I checked, there were about 100 ICU beds currently available in Colorado, as per the Denver Post. And what happens when those fill up? Are patients treated in hallways? What do we do when a patient needs an ICU? They need it. So here we are 20 months into this pandemic, and we should be reaching herd immunity, and this should be in the rearview mirror, yet it's not. So what's really what's going on? With all complicated situations, it's never simple. We don't have simple answers. It's multifactorial, but I'll try to go through some of the factors that may be playing a role here. How much of the current hospital care is non-COVID related? Don't forget that during the pandemic, the past 2 years, a lot of routine and elective surgery was deferred over fears of catching COVID. Patients didn't want to come into the hospital. We're constantly changing rules regarding testing, masks, vaccines, et cetera. So some patients have chosen to wait until things return to a semblance of normal before venturing back into the hospital for elective surgery, cataract surgery, hernia, whatever. Some of those things can wait. Cancer screenings were also deferred. So the mammograms, the colonoscopies, the biopsies, many of those were deferred over the past year and a half, especially when case counts were high and elective surgery was not being done. And now people are trying to catch up and get those things taken care of. Many people with bad knees and hips are finally getting them replaced. Hernias are getting fixed. Heart surgery is getting done. Also, don't forget that most insurance plan deductibles reset at the end of the year. So there's a big surge in demand, particularly this time of year, for patients that have already met their deductible to try to get their care in now while it's covered by insurance, because in January they start a new deductible and everything is, if you have a high deductible plan, you're paying cash for everything until you meet your deductible. A lot of patients are trying to get their surgeries done now, fearing exactly what's happening, that there would be a surge at the end of the year, and trying to get their surgery done now before hospitals start turning patients away or canceling elective surgery. And recall that simple procedures are done as an outpatient. And in my world of eye surgery, virtually all of what we do is done as an outpatient, but more complex surgeries like heart surgery, big bowel cases, et cetera, are done as an inpatient. And many of these patients require an ICU stay after their surgery. The ICU isn't just for the sick COVID patients. A lot of other type patients end up in the ICU, heart attacks, things like that. And because of the cost involved in running and staffing an ICU, it needs to be relatively full to justify the staff, the equipment, and other services, respiratory therapy, et cetera, that are needed for running an ICU. This is much like airlines. They prefer to have their planes fly with only a few empty seats because from a business perspective, their costs are fixed, the cost of fuel, staff, pilots, et cetera. So hospitals are business too, and they need the sufficient revenue to cover their costs. The news articles about ICUs being full doesn't discuss whether the shortage represents physical beds or the ability to staff those beds. And that's a very important distinction. For example, if a hospital has a 40-bed ICU, but only staffed to care for 20 patients, and they have a census of 19 patients, they're reported to be full with only one empty bed. Although in reality, they may have 20 empty beds, but they don't have the staff to cover those. Think about with a restaurant. Back in the days when there was restaurants were running at 50% capacity, when they opened up for dining, you'd go in and you'd see a lot of empty tables. Well, you may have gotten the last reservation and the restaurant may be considered fully booked, even with those empty tables. But that's because that's all they can staff. They may only have wait service or other restrictions that can only fulfill half and staff half the table. So that's a big distinction to make when you hear about hospitals and ICUs being full. Is it physical beds or is it the ability to staff them? And that's a nuance that is really not reported or dealt with. And that can distort the picture. Hospital staffing may also be an issue. Remember, more than 100 million Americans are out of the workforce, and a lot of these include healthcare workers. If healthcare workers are not there, you can't staff the beds, you can't staff the ICUs. Many healthcare workers are burnt out after a long year and a half of COVID, being on the front lines, worrying about their own health. Others have reprioritized their lives and activities and may not be willing to work as hard or work in such a stressful environment. Many now have the opportunity to work remotely and not have to deal with that. Others are resisting vaccine mandates. And I'd say most healthcare workers have been vaccinated, but not all. And those that are, have not by this point are probably not going to and would rather not work. So all these things contribute to staffing shortages. Yes, and Dr. Donna commented in the chat about how many workers are needed. ICU, for example, nurses care for one or maximum two patients. So for every bed, you need literally half a nurse, you need a respiratory therapist, you need a nurse's aide, you need pharmacy technicians. There's a tremendous amount of staffing that goes on in the ICU. And if you don't have the staff, you can't have the beds, just like you can't fly a plane if you don't have pilot, co-pilot, and sufficient cabin crew and baggage crew, et cetera. And that's why a lot of flights get canceled. So seasonality is also playing a role with COVID. As the weather turns cooler, residents of northern states like Colorado or Idaho, where I am at the moment, are moving indoors because the weather's cooler. And indoors is where COVID and other viruses can spread more easily. Unlike in the summer, when people were outside, people were hiking, playing golf, bicycling, walking, and that's less so now. And eventually the numbers will probably plateau and drop. But if you look at Florida and southern states that were had big COVID surges in the summer, that's when people were indoors because it's hot down there in the summer, hot and humid, and people go indoors where it's air conditioned. And again, that's where viruses are more likely to spread. Now that it's cooled down in the southern states, people are getting out and the surge is going away, and it's now the northern states. So there is a seasonality to this, which again, the media doesn't like to delve into or explain. Instead of calling Governor DeSantis Death Santis and names like that, blaming him for the surge, well, they're not commenting now that Florida's doing quite well in its northern states. Michigan, I think, has the most cases now, and it's a northern state where it's cool and people are indoors. Also, Vermont. Vermont is one of the most vaccinated states in the country. It was the model for COVID response, and yet it's having its worst surge yet. So they like to blame red state governors and Republicans when it's convenient to do so, but they don't extend the same criticism to blue state governors, appropriately or inappropriately. It's not so much the governor's doing as what the virus does and how the seasons affect it. Comment from Dr. Donna, not sure they do not get the shot because they do not want to work. There's multiple reasons why healthcare workers are in short supply. I think a lot of them are just burnt out, don't want to work, and that's independent of vaccine status. But there are some that are resisting the mandates, and you need to be vaccinated in order to work in healthcare, certainly in Colorado. And some people are not working because of that. So there's multiple factors. And RSV is a big problem, especially in children. So how accurate the test is, that's a whole nother subject. And whether the COVID PCR test is testing positive, false positive, when it could be other viruses, we don't know. And that's a whole nother subject. But RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, typically affects children. And we're seeing more, quote, cases in children. And whether these are COVID or RSV or combination, the when you have an overly sensitive COVID PCR test, it may be picking up other things, including the flu. We really don't know what exactly people have. So waning vaccine immunity is being suggested as a possibility. And in other words, the vaccines may provide some degree of immunity for a few months, and then it seems to fade. And still, there's no discussion or acknowledgement of natural immunity. People that have had COVID, that have developed immunity through their own immune system. And that's probably a better way forward, because that will provide immunity against variations and other things that the vaccine immunity may not. If the vaccine mutates, and they always say you shouldn't be vaccinating in the midst of a pandemic because you're forcing the vaccine to mutate, and it can mutate into other strains which are perhaps more lethal, more contagious, etc. And that's another reason why we might be getting these surges. It's like giving a weak antibiotic to someone with an infection. You create resistant bugs, and that's not a good way to create long-lasting immunity. You get vaccine resistance, you get antibiotic resistance, and that creates superbugs, and maybe that's what we're dealing with as well. Hospitals are difficult places to work these days, far from the high standards in the 80s and 90s. Hospitals are difficult. They're like most businesses, they're highly regulated. There's a lot of rules and requirements and whatnot. And yeah, hospitals are a more challenging place to work. And as a result, they're dealing with staff shortages, but again, for a variety of reasons. The other thing to realize is that COVID patients spend a long time in the hospital. Many are in the hospital for weeks or months, utilizing beds, and that may account for some of the COVID hospitalization. It's not clear whether these patients are that we're hearing about are in for observation and go home in a few days, or these are the long haulers that are in for a long time. COVID has also created a mental health crisis where COVID patients that have lost their jobs or have medical issues, long hauler COVID patients that have mental health issues, end up in the emergency room and are difficult to place. Mental health care is challenging these days. There are very few inpatient beds, and it's what to do with these patients. And these may be, quote, COVID patients that are stuck in emergency rooms and hospitals waiting to be placed. So that's another thing that keeps the hospital beds full, because they have to place these patients in mental health facilities, and it may not be so easy. So the point is, there's a variety of reasons why we have a recent surge in COVID cases and hospitalizations, and it's important to look beyond just the news headlines in terms of what's going on. Note that cases will rise and fall. There does seem to be seasonality, and if you look at the plots of cases in Colorado and elsewhere, they rise, they fall, they rise, they fall. And hopefully with enough natural immunity, as people get sick and recover, this will eventually mitigate and become less of a problem. But that's going to take time. The bigger question is, the vaccine benefit and whether the vaccines are helping, hurting, or having no effect on all of this. They claim that the vaccines would, prevent COVID, stop you from transmitting, from catching it, and that turned out to be false. The CDC director acknowledged as much. And if vaccines are actually creating more resistant strains of the virus, that's simply going to aggravate things. So lots of factors here. And hopefully the current peak in Colorado, if you look at the plot on the Denver Post webpage, it's the trend line is that it will be heading down soon. And hopefully that's the case, and not keep going up and up. But here we are. We have mask mandates now. The latest news, let me see what we have in the chat here about DORA and education standards in healthcare. Yeah, it's I think medical school is still challenging, but there's a lot going on in medical school, which is a whole nother subject. But political correctness, wokeness, call it what you want, with big emphasis on equity, tolerance, diversity, et cetera. And hopefully not at the expense of hard science, which is what's important for a physician to be trained and know their anatomy, physiology, pharmacology. Gender diversity and other things are not going to make one a good doctor. They may be more woke, but when it comes to figuring out complicated diseases, treating patients, coming up with the right therapies, there's no substitute for knowledge and experience, and hopefully that's not being shortchanged. So the recent news in Colorado is that, at least in Metro Denver, is that mask mandates are back in place. We've got Tri-County Health Department and Arapahoe County, where I live, is going back to requiring masks for indoor public activities, which means it's going to be that way at the mall, at stores, shopping centers, health clubs. At my health club, we had to wear masks earlier in the year, and it was really annoying. It's hard to work out, particularly if you're doing anything cardio related, with a mask on. It affects your breathing, and it's just uncomfortable. And I thought we were past that, but I had a sneaking suspicion that wouldn't be the end of it. And here we are, with mask mandates back in place. And at least according to what I've read, this is until early January, perhaps later. They have metrics of how many ICU beds are available, hospital beds, et cetera. And until we get below a certain percentage and keep it there for a few weeks, the mask mandates will stay in place. So my guess is that we're going to see this through the holidays and into January, perhaps February, until things are settling down. And that's unfortunate. There's a lot of controversy about masks and whether they help, how much they help, if they do at all. You have to realize that the pore size in a standard surgical mask is at least 10 times larger than the average size of a respiratory virus. So there are memes and analogies out there about trying to stop mosquitoes with a chain link fence, and that's really what it's like. Masks have not been used in previous viral pandemics because they generally don't work. It's great if you're sneezing, coughing, and it keeps droplets, but these viruses are small and are spread by aerosols, which are not droplets. And while the mask may catch a sneeze or a cough, aerosols go right through the pores in the mask. And you can tell that by wearing a surgical mask around somebody that's smoking. You will smell the cigarette smoke quite clearly, or any other odor. The only masks that really work are properly fitted N95 masks, but those are worn by healthcare workers and have to be properly fitted and tested. That's not what you and I are wearing when we go to King Soopers or go to the health club or go to the mall. It's just the standard surgical masks. And are they really doing anything or more for show? It seems the public health officials are understandably panicked because cases are going up and they're trying to do something, anything that might mitigate it. But I don't know that masks are really going to solve much. And nobody talks about the unintended consequences of masks. Number one, it's cost. Number two, walk around the parking lot and see masks littering the ground. You see them on the streets. They're everywhere. And these masks are mainly plastic. They're not biodegradable. And they're going to end up in landfills. They're going to end up in oceans. The elastic on the masks is going to tangle up birds and ocean life. Remember the outcry over the plastic rings that held a six pack of beer or soda, and how seabirds and fish and other things were getting tangled up in those things. Well, you're going to see the same with masks. They're not biodegradable, and they're going to create tons and tons of pollution that nobody seems to be thinking about or talking about. So that's one downside, is the pollution from masks. And also, if these masks are stopping a virus, we just throw them in the trash. Is that really the way to dispose something? If you have contaminated disposable gear in the hospital or anything, it's disposed of in special bags and then decontaminated. There's a process for that. But with surgical masks, there's nothing. They're just thrown on the ground, thrown in the trash. So if they're containing virus, as they're purported to do, why are we just throwing them out and not disposing of them properly? That's a question nobody seems to want to answer. Comment in the chat about Cora request of those who have passed, status regarding the shot. Yeah, it's interesting. You're not considered fully vaccinated until you've had the second dose, if it's a two-dose vaccine, which certainly Moderna and Pfizer are. So if somebody gets COVID a week after their second dose, they're not considered vaccinated. So they're considered unvaccinated and go into that statistic. Likewise, if they have a vaccine reaction and get sick or even die a few days after their vaccine, they're not considered vaccinated. So it's interesting how they report the numbers, and not necessarily a good way of reporting it if you're not counting people as vaccinated until 2 weeks. Most of the people that have serious vaccine adverse events, it happens in the first week or even in the first few days. Are those being counted as vaccine adverse reactions? We don't know. And I'm going to talk a little bit about vaccine safety. I also will put out the caveat that I am not anti-vaccine. So if there are any busybodies listening and want to report me to the medical authorities as being anti-vaccination, I've been fully vaccinated since January of this year, early in the year. So I've had my vaccines, and I'm certainly not anti-vaccine, but I'm pro-science, and I'm pro-asking questions, looking at the news, analyzing it, and that's what we're doing. We're having a discussion about pros and cons of these things. So it's not an anti-vaccine tirade. So I had the opportunity to watch the movie Moneyball recently. I've seen it before, but years and years ago, but watched it again. And it's about the Oakland Athletics general manager, Billy Beane, and his approach to scouting players and using metrics rather than subjective impressions that traditional baseball scouts use. And he had a good line in the beginning of the movie when he was gathered with all the scouts and they were discussing prospective players. And the quote is, if he's a good hitter, why doesn't he hit good? And, you know, intuitively that makes sense. The scouts all had great explanations of why a player should be a good hitter, from, you know, the sound of the crack of the bat when they hit the ball, to their looks, to all sorts of things, but none of those things predicted whether these would be good players or not. But the numbers tell a different story, and the numbers are on base percentage, batting average, things like that. So Billy Beane wanted players that got on base because that predicted wins. And once his system got into play and he got the right players, the Oakland Athletics started winning, which was a kind of the premise in the movie. So what if we ask the same question about the vaccines? If the vaccines work, why aren't they working? So again, I'm not anti-vaccine. I'm asking questions about it because this is important. We're being told we have to have vaccines. We're vaccinating most of the population. We've got 80%+ of eligible people for vaccines in Colorado have been vaccinated, and yet we're seeing cases going through the roof. And the question is, well, why is that? Are the vaccines not working? What's going on here? And this is a question shouldn't just be me asking. This should be on Nine News or Fox News or the Denver Post or other news organizations saying, hey, you know, we have a mostly vaccinated population, yet cases are going through the roof. And that's all we're hearing about: crisis standards of care, limited ICU beds, ICUs full in some hospitals. Why is that happening? And that's the question I'm posing here. So why am I giving this disclaimer? Well, it's as a physician, it's we all have to be careful what we say and talk about. The American Federation of Medical Specialists put out a statement a few months ago, and I'm quoting, "Physicians who generate and spread COVID-19 vaccine misinformation or disinformation are risking disciplinary action by state medical boards, including suspension or revocation of their medical license." Well, hopefully asking questions and discussing it is not considered misinformation or disinformation. It's the scientific process where we ask and inquire. Recall that once upon a time, back in the 1950s, it was customary that pregnant women got x-rayed. And that's not practice anymore, but at the time it was considered standard care. And anybody that questioned it was probably considered a heretic. Yet if you look back on it now, it says, yeah, that's crazy. Why would anybody want to x-ray pregnant women? But again, at the time, that was considered standard medical practice. But this is the serious thing about hospitals and medical boards that are doing that. There's a physician in Houston, an ear, nose, and throat specialist, that was suspended from her hospital for tweeting about vaccine mandates and ivermectin. And that's not a good thing. I've got a furnace in the background that turned on, and I don't know how to turn it off. So I'm going to shift position a little bit just so I don't have a lot of background noise. So pardon the change in venue, but we do what we got to do here. So hopefully a little quieter and easier to hear you. And Dr. Donna raised a question about natural immunity, which I'll delve into briefly, but natural immunity is considered better than vaccine immunity because it's long lasting. Natural immunity, you get immunity to a number of the proteins on the virus, and natural immunity turns into, as opposed to just antibodies, you get T cell and B cell immunity, which is called humoral immunity, which is long lasting, perhaps lasting your entire life. They looked at natural immunity from the SARS outbreak in 2003, and 17, 18 years later, which is now, that immunity is still robust. So that suggests that this is lifelong immunity. And there have been studies from Israel and other locations where they looked at natural immunity from COVID-19, and it's lasting, you know, at least a year. But that's about how long it's been out. This, you can't say COVID immunity lasts for 20 years because it hasn't been around for 20 years. It's only been a year and a half that we've been dealing with this. But so far, that seems to be robust, and long-acting. Vaccine immunity is to the spike protein, not the other proteins on the virus, nucleocapsid, other proteins. So it's a more limited immunity, and if the spike protein changes, mutates, then this immunity may not last, which is why we're having boosters. It's not to say the vaccines are bad, it's just they're short-acting, and Dr. Fauci has admitted as much, that it seems to be a waning immunity that doesn't last, and hence the need for boosters. If the original vaccine immunity was long-acting, there'd be no need for a booster. But we're already giving boosters and talking about the next round of boosters. And where does it end? I mean, is it really a vaccine that provides long-term immunity, or more of a temporary therapeutic? And if we keep having to boost, that suggests that it's short-term. Anyhow, So what the CDC website says is that COVID-19 vaccines are safe, effective, and free. And that's a quote. So those words are all relative. So let's unpack those a little bit and start with safety. There's something called VAERS, which you may have heard of in the news. It's called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And it's a website, and it's voluntary reporting of vaccine adverse reactions. And it's a bit complicated to fill out, and a lot of these are not reported. But if you do go to their website, you can compare COVID vaccine adverse events from the past 11 months that are on the website compared to adverse events from all vaccines over the past 30 years, 1990 and onward. So this is two different data sets. One is basically a one-year data set. One is a 30-year data set. And there are many vaccines that are out there. Shingles, influenza, measles, mumps, hepatitis, and so forth. And if you compare the 11 months of COVID versus 30 years of all the other vaccines for this long period of time, a lot of the adverse events are the categories are pretty similar between them. And again, it's 1 year versus 30 years. If you look specifically at hospitalizations, deaths, permanent disabilities, and birth defects, according to the VAERS website, I'm not making this up, those adverse events are higher in the 11 months of COVID vaccines than they are for 30 years of all the other types of vaccines. And that's concerning. Note that VAERS is voluntary reporting and not all the cases make it there. And I actually looked up to see, you know, how much underreporting there is. VAERS did their own analysis about 10 years ago. And at that time, quote, fewer than 1% of vaccine adverse events are reported. Their words, not mine. So the numbers could be a lot higher. And that's not only for COVID, but for the other vaccines. But we're already seeing in 11 months higher vaccine reactions with COVID vaccines than with all the others combined. So that's worth noting. And that's something that should be part of the discussion. Any medical intervention is a balance between risks and benefits. And that needs to be part of the dialogue, not just you have to do this and end of discussion. So that needs to be reported. And if the vaccines are indeed safe, then we shouldn't be seeing all these adverse events. And that needs to be reconciled because that makes people hesitant and fearful about getting either vaccinated or getting boosters. So that needs to be reported on more. Are they effective? That's the next question. So according to the CDC, again, COVID-19 vaccines reduce the risk of infection by 91% for fully vaccinated people. It makes illness milder, shorter for the few vaccinated people who do get COVID-19. Well, is that true? I mean, is it reducing infection? Well, let's look at what's going on in the world, not just take the CDC at their word. Gibraltar, a small country in Europe. Gibraltar is completely vaccinated. Everybody there has been vaccinated. In reality, they are 118% vaccinated, meaning that a number of their population has already had the booster. And yet they're having a surge in cases. So how to explain that? There was a headline in the news, most vaccinated place on earth told to cancel holiday plans amid an exponential rise in COVID cases. And that needs to be explained. Why is a country where everybody's been vaccinated having a surge in cases? That doesn't make sense, but there it is. Is that only Gibraltar? No, you can pick other countries. I'll read you another headline. 93% vaccinated Ireland has gone into partial lockdown, including midnight curfew, because they have spiking cases. Austria is going into lockdown. Other European countries, Germany, will probably follow, all having surges in cases despite high vaccination rates. Or this headline, COVID surge in Singapore despite 80% vaccination. Or from the UK, the rates of COVID infection per 100,000 are now higher among the vaxxed than the unvaxxed. So clearly something is not right here, and this is something that should be discussed, analyzed, and we should have more forthcoming reporting from the media than we do. But these are the headlines out there, and they seem to be ignored, and we're not getting good explanations from the health authorities of how to explain these contradictions. What do we have in the comments here? Yes, the 1% reporting on VAERS, Megyn Kelly interview. Yeah, there's a lot of anecdotal stories of young, healthy people getting vaccinated and having very bad reactions. Well, if there was a new drug out there that was doing that, that would promptly be pulled from the market. We have a drug that's injected in eyes and that is used in my profession, and it's got a 4% rate of inflammation when injected, and, you know, black box warnings, and a lot of people refuse to use it because of that. And that's a very small percent, but it's enough to raise alarm bells. So anything that's causing adverse events like this needs to be studied. And we need answers. Part of informed consent for any medical intervention is looking at risks and benefits. And that all has to be presented quite clearly. So aside from Gibraltar, look in the U.S., perhaps Vermont. Another quote from the news. Vermont has the highest vaccination rate in the country, so why are cases surging? Well, we're seeing the same in Colorado. Colorado has 80% of the eligible population has been, it's received at least one vaccine dose, meaning partially vaccinated, yet cases are surging. Colorado's COVID hospitalizations jump again as virus's statewide death toll surpasses 9,000. So if you look on the Denver Post, has a hospitalization tracker, and the current case surge is approaching what it was in last December. Some speculate that it may be worse. We'll see over the next few weeks. But when you have 80% of the population has been vaccinated and you're seeing these surges, you have to wonder. And good science says you look into this and try to explain it. So this is not misinformation. This is not disinformation. This is what's out there in the media. These are headlines I found with just simple internet search, and it's being reported, but that's as far as it goes. It's headlines and a little bit of discussion, but we're not hearing from the health authorities of why this is, reassuring the population and making a case that we are indeed doing the right thing in spite of these contradictory figures. The CDC on their website says, research provides evidence that COVID-19 vaccines are effective at preventing COVID-19. And that's a quote from the CDC. Yet we're seeing spiking cases, surges in these countries that are highly vaccinated and states that are highly vaccinated. And that goes against what the CDC is saying. So really the onus is on them to, you know, explain that. And why are we seeing that? Why is our cases going up with more people being vaccinated? That doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense from a science perspective or a common sense perspective, and needs to be explained. Lastly is the free claim. CDC claims the vaccines are free, and it's always interesting when the government says something is free, because anything provided by the government is truly not free. So let's talk a little bit about free. This is not a medical issue, but more of a economic and big government issue. Just because those who receive the vaccine are not charged for it, it doesn't mean it's free. Reality is the government does not produce anything. They simply tax, or more realistic term, confiscate people's money and then redistribute it in the way they see fit. But they're not producing, so nothing is truly free. The government takes our money and gives it back to us, or buys things on our behalf and gives them to us and then says it's free. Well, it's really not. So let's look at a little bit of the numbers. The Pfizer vaccine costs about $20 per dose. That's what the government pays for it. The other vaccines are in the same ballpark. 445 million doses have been administered in the U.S. to date. Probably more as of today, but that's the latest number I found. That's $9 billion right there. Spending on research and development has been estimated to be about $40 billion. So we're well north of $50 billion spent on this, and there's probably a lot more in terms of hidden or non-transparent costs. So it's hardly free. When you're talking trillion-dollar budgets, $50 billion's not that much, but it's still quite a bit. So the idea that it's free is not so much. Look at it another way. Pfizer is expected to make $36 billion in COVID vaccine revenues in 2021, and that's big money. So the big pharma companies are making a lot, and where are they contributing? Whose campaigns? Whose re-elections, etc.? There's a incestuous money trail through Washington, D.C. of politicians supporting industries that make money and then give the money back. Some might call it money laundering, but it's worth looking at. These are the kind of things that shows like 60 Minutes used to explore in terms of the military-industrial complex and politicians supporting military projects and weapon systems and planes, and then those companies contributing to the politicians or hiring them after they retire from Congress. And there should be some accountability and transparency there of where all this money is going. And unfortunately, there's not. So what it really comes down to, there's nothing wrong with the medical establishment says, we don't know, or we're not sure. But they seem very cocksure about everything, and get the vaccine, they're safe, effective, and yet they're not explaining some of these contradictions, like how can a very vaccinated country or state be having a surge in cases? That doesn't make sense. It's not anti-vaccine. It just doesn't make sense. So what else do we have in the comments? Biologic warfare, tax money, people making money, donors, politicians. Yeah, well, that's kind of the story of Congress and our political elites and ruling class, is that they do very well financially controlling the purse strings. Congress controls the purse strings. Budgets are always initiated out of the House, and there's money to be made. And that's how people that have been serving in Congress for many years, making $180,000, $200,000 a year, good money, but that's not, that kind of salary doesn't give you a net worth of $20, $30 million after a congressional career. So where is all this money coming from? Harry Reid, for example, Senate Majority Leader a few years ago, long career in Congress, but his net worth is between $20 and $30 million. How does that happen? Maxine Waters, some of these other members of Congress that have multiple homes and are doing quite well. Even President Biden has multiple homes, and his wife is a college professor, and he's been living on a government salary for 30, 40 years, not more than $200,000 a year. Yet they have multiple homes and quite wealthy. And I won't get into other areas where he might have gotten money, but that's kind of the incestuous nature of our political ruling class of how they get money. So the problem we see is that those that are tasking us to follow the science may not be following the science themselves. If so, they're not explaining contradictory things like what we're seeing now of these vaccinated locations having a surge in cases. And that needs to be dealt with and explained. It can't just be ignored because people see these things and naturally they have concern. Dr. Fauci, in an interview with the New York Times a week or so ago, acknowledged, quote, they are seeing a waning of immunity, not only against infection, but against hospitalization and to some extent death, which is starting now to involve all age groups. It isn't just the elderly. So what they said initially was incorrect. It turned out to be incorrect. And instead of fessing up and really acknowledging it, other than just, you know, a few words in an interview that you have to dig for, they should be talking about this. It's okay for medical people to be wrong. If we're facing a viral pandemic of a novel virus or something we haven't dealt with before, it's okay not to have all the answers. We don't have the answers for a lot of things in medicine. But to be so darn sure and willing to throw anybody that questions it under the bus, calling them names, shaming them, things like that, that's really not advancing science in any meaningful way. The few doctors that are out there on the front lines that you see on the news that are talking about these things, Dr. McCullough, Dr. Malone, Bhattacharya, et cetera, there are a number of these doctors that are questioning these things, and they're, you know, they're called names, they're ostracized, they're banning them from social media, et cetera, instead of having a meaningful discussion and addressing their concern and trying to find answers to this rather than just saying it's my way or the highway. Last thing that's interesting is the FDA wants 55 years to process Freedom of Information Act request over vaccine data, which is kind of interesting. 55 years to go through the data before it can be released to the public. The FDA took 108 days to review Pfizer's clinical trial data. And in those 3.5 months, determined that the vaccine was, quote, safe and effective, which is the FDA's mandate, and they approved it. Yet they need 55 years before releasing this data to the public. This is far from transparency. And again, you know, raises red flags of, is there something here to hide or something to be concerned about? So there are a lot of issues about the vaccines and how they work that are not being discussed or suppressed. And here we are almost 2 years into this, and it doesn't seem to be going away. We seem to be going backwards. Got vaccine mandates, we're back to masking. Pretty soon we may be having business closures, social distancing, capacity limits, et cetera. And that's not a good thing. And instead of the government, you know, being forthright and honest about things and discussing it, we're really balkanizing the world. Vaccinated versus unvaccinated, us versus them, the worthy versus the lepers. And it's really just creating more and more division in an already divided society. And that's really not good for anybody. So I will leave it at that. We're about at the end of time. And I've enjoyed chatting with everybody. And hope you all have a great Thanksgiving. And Merry Christmas and holidays and all of that, despite having to be masked up. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it is. And hopefully one of these days we can return to a semblance of normal life. All right. Thanks, everyone. And I will sign off at this point.